Hello and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and we have a very special show for you today. I have author Roy Harper on the line with me, and just want to let everyone know in advance, we'll have to take a break about midway through the show for just a minute, as we are limited on the amount of time Roy can be on the line with us. So I'll just ask you please be patient while we reconnect with him at that point. A little bit about our guest. Roy Harper has been incarcerated since 1981 for armed robbery. He's gained nationwide notoriety for two highly publicized escapes from a maximum security prison in 1983 and 2000, and also for his efforts in the courts to reduce brutality and injustice in American prisons. And of great interest to us, he also happens to be the author of a couple of excellent crime fiction novels. The first is titled Shank, and the follow-up is Heist, and both are published by Crimewave Press. So, Roy Harper, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to connect with you today.
All right. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk to you. Let's start by talking a little bit about your background. I watched the National Geographic documentary about your escape from Supermax, and I've read a couple of articles. And you have some experiences in life that gives you, you know, strong sense of authority and authenticity to your work. So if you could tell us a little bit about your life experiences and how they've shaped your fiction writing.
Well, I've always heard you should write what you know, and I've been in prison for. Since 1981 on these charges right here in Mississippi. And when I first got arrested, it was my mindset that I needed to escape. And there was no other way around it because I wasn't ever going to get out legally. And I stayed with that mindset through the whole time that I've been in prison. And in 1983, I was in a maximum security unit in Parchman, and I managed to get some hacksaw blades in and saw through the window and crawled down the wall and across the yard, crawled over a fence, and escaped. And as a matter of fact, I was rearrested here in Colorado, in Littleton, Colorado, for bank robbery, attempted murder, and they sent me back to Mississippi to serve that time there, and then I kept my mentality up about needing to get out any way I could, escape or whatever, and they opened up Unit 32 in 1990, and they sent me there. I was the first one in there, and In 1993, I attempted to escape again from there. They moved me to the front cell where the inside control tower could see into my cell, see what I was doing in there all the time. And years later, in 2000, I managed to get hold of more hacksaw blades. And it took some doing, but I saw through the window, tried to saw through the bars, and they were salt proof, I found out. But the window itself, the frame around the window was a softer type of metal. And I saw through that and through the bottom of it and found a place there that was wide enough to get out. And crawled across the yard to the perimeter fences and cut through the fences and wiggled through the razor wire, cut through the outside fence and got away. And I had a partner with me, and we were pulled over in Indiana by the police, and my partner pulled over. He was driving the van that we had stolen, and the police pulled us over, and my partner was holding a shotgun in his lap, and he shot a cop and missed him, point blank range almost. Anyway, the cop fell on the ground, started shooting back, filled our van up with bullets, and we took off and had a high speed chase and shooting at the police, and they were shooting back, and they ended up blowing our tires out with the stop sticks. But we got away. It was like 3 days later when we were finally caught and put back in jail, sent back to Mississippi. And that was in 2000, so it's been all those years that I've been locked up since.
Wow, so yeah, you've been there and done it and lived it and experienced it. So when you write, you know, a novel about someone escaping from Unit 32, you know, you've got the experience under your belt to really lend that air of authenticity to your fiction. Yeah, what a fascinating story. Roy, you have two novels to your credit at this point published, Shank and Heist, and both feature David Toole Roney and published by Crimewave Press. For any of our listeners who may be unfamiliar with those novels, could you just kind of set them up and tell us just a little bit about what these books are about?
Yeah, well, like I said, I've always heard that you should write what you know and what you've lived, you know. So my protagonist, David Toole Roney, starts in prison. That's where the book starts. And he's doing life without parole for armed robbery, and during this sentence that he's serving, he encounters he has an incident with another inmate, theft of some of his property. The guy broke into his locker and caused an incident between him and Roney, and Roney ended up killing the guy that broke into his locker, which lands him in maximum security unit 17. And during this time when he's at 17, he meets other characters there, people that were either on death row or other state inmates. And during his time in 17, he meets his two guys that he escaped with, which were Madman and Choke, two of the other death row inmates. And together, they all plotted and schemed till they could figure out a way to get out of prison. And a change in the prison procedures is what opened up the door for him to get out. And him and these two guys followed through with the plans and overtook the prison and escaped. And that's the first book. And then in the second one is Heist. Same thing, only they're not prisoners anymore. And Roney is out there alone now. The other two guys ended up being dead. But Roney killed one of them and the cops killed the other one. And While Roney's out there in the world, he has to make a living. And the only way he knew to make one was with a gun, armed robbery. And through his experiences while he was out there, he did make a few dollars. And he met a girl. Her name was Rose. And she began to change his life through his affections toward her and hers towards him. And as the story progresses, he commits a few more crimes, and then later in the book, meets a youngster. A kid, he's just a kid, a runaway. And Rose takes the kid in and lets him stay where Roney's staying at. It's a house in the middle of the country, a place where he's comfortable with, and he and Rose are living. And the kid doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know who Roney is. He just thinks he's a guy that took him in and was helping his life be better as he was living the life of a runaway. And as the two were living together, an incident, Ronnie ended up giving the kid a motorcycle, a crotch rocket, and which was something the kid had been wanting his entire life anyway. And at some point, the kid is in the post office and sees a picture of Ronnie in there on the wall, that he's a wanted man and he's wanted for murder and escape and so forth. And so when the kid comes out of the post office, he sees Ronnie on the interstate. He's been pulled over by the police. So he cranks the motorcycle up to its full potential and flies by the cop, missing him by inches, and which causes the cop to be pissed off. And he jumps back in his car to chase the kid. He doesn't know it. He thought maybe the cops were arresting Ronnie, you know, but it was just a traffic ticket. But anyway, the kid ends up getting away and makes it back to the hideout where they were staying at. And he spoke with Ronnie. Ronnie was pissed off at him. He didn't know why the kid had done that. And anyway, it ends up he finds out that the kid had seen the poster. And what impressed him most was that there was a warrant. I mean, on the warrant, there's a reward for Ronnie, which was like $60,000. And he asked the kid if he could read, because he assumed that he could, you know. And the kid said, "Yeah, I can read." He said, "Well, you know, you could have got $60,000 and been living a lot better right now." And the kid said, "Yeah, I wouldn't turn you in if it was $50 million. And Ronnie was impressed by the kid's loyalty and everything. So anyway, they start scheming together. The kid wanted to rob too, and Ronnie wouldn't hear of it. And towards later on in the story, though, he finally figures out how the kid will be involved in an armored car heist. And they do that, and the kid's excited about it, and Rody was excited about it. And they did pull the heist. And made their getaway, got away from the state. But then Rose was calling back. I mean, her memory, you know. And he ends up coming back to the United States. Because Ronnie bought a boat, a sailboat, and that's how they got back to his sailboat. And called Rose when he got back. And they got together and got married. And the guy that married him was a father that he knew who Ronnie was. And he ended up marrying him and leaving him there off the coast of San Francisco. So.
Wow, yeah, I mean, that's...
And then... Excuse me?
Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh. The main guy, the main antagonist from the book, a prison employee, was he had a boat that he ran. He'd been following Rose because he knew she was going to lead him to Ronnie eventually. And it turns out he was insane, and out on the ocean he ran him down with his boat and came out of the one that he had rented. He was carrying an AK-47 and was trying to arrest him. And anyway, there's a dog in the book called Poncho. Poncho all of a sudden darted out from around the side of the boat and grabbed him on the ass, beat him on the ass, made him stagger backwards to the opening of the boat when Rose blew him away with a shotgun. And that's pretty much the end of the book.
Wow, yeah, that's a it really, you know, it's a compelling story, you know, with Dave's escape and trying to get through in life. You have some unique characters in your books, you know, Dustball and Rose and her father and Poncho. But you know, Rose to me is a special, unique character, I think. Very lifelike. And I'm just curious, where did you come up with Rose and what was your inspiration for her?
Well, I have a sister she's basically been an outlaw her entire life. She's older than me. And I base a lot of my writings and descriptions off of Rose, off of that sister. And she is a unique character, and I hope people who read the book will find her as attractive as I did. I fell in love with her myself, even though she's not a real person, you know. And yeah, she's somebody that I felt like Roni needed.
Well, yeah, I think you definitely accomplished, you know, a character that people are going to love and remember. And
we have 60 seconds remaining.
Hey, this is a good place for us to stop and reconnect, Roy. And when I have you come back on, we've got a couple of callers on. I'll pause and we'll bring the callers on. They can talk to you, and then we'll jump back into the interview afterward. But if you want to go ahead and drop, then we'll reconnect, and we'll continue from there.
All right.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
All right. Thank you. I'll be calling back in a minute.
Thank you. Okay. We'll be waiting.
All right.
And you know, while we're waiting for Roy to reconnect, I want to let you know about. A special edition of Noir on the Radio that I have scheduled for Sunday, March the 12th. And that show, it's going to be March the 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I'll have a panel of authors. We'll have Sean Cosby, Eric Pruitt, Tony Knighton, Rob Pierce on with me. And with this panel, we'll be discussing the Parker novels by Richard Stark. And the impact of those novels on current crime fiction. And that'll be, again, Sunday, March the 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern, and the recorded podcast will be available after the live event as well. We're going up opposite The Walking Dead, so I trust everyone will record The Walking Dead and listen live to the live event of the Richard Stark panel. But just in case that doesn't happen, we'll have the Reported Cut podcast out there as well. And then the following week, I'll have Robert J. Rindisi on with me, and he will be talking about his new book, Lady Gunsmith, that's up and coming. And in the weeks to come, I'll have more noir and crime authors. We've got Krista Faust and Gary Phillips coming on to talk about the Peepland series and a few other good folks as well. So once we get Roy back on the line, we'll bring the callers on. I've got two callers waiting currently, one from area code 443 and then one from area code 516, and we'll bring you on in that order so you can talk to Roy. I'm just going to check and see if he's back on the line. All right, it looks like Roy is coming back up, so we'll bring him back on.
Black.
Hi, Roy. Welcome back.
Hey. Yeah.
Hey. I'm going to bring a caller on to talk with us, and then we'll get back into our interview after a couple of calls. Hello, caller
All
from
right.
area code 443. You're on Noir on the Radio. Who do we have on the line?
This is Margaret Winter.
Yes.
Hi, Roy.
Hey.
Hi, Roy.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Martha.
Yes.
Martha, do you have a question for Roy? Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I do have a question for Roy. Roy, I was wondering if you could tell your listeners something about the major role that you played in federal court litigation that resulted in a very far-reaching changes to the conditions in Unit 32 that you mentioned earlier, the Supermax Solitary Confinement Unit in at Mississippi State Penitentiary, which was certainly one of the most, if not the most, cruel and barbaric prisons in the U.S. at the time. You played a very major role in changing, improving the conditions there and finally shutting the place down. And that's how we met when I was associate director of the ACLU National Prison Project, and you were the inspiration and main man in the litigation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, ma'am. I was incarcerated in Unit 32 since 1990, and they moved me from the rear cell up to the front as an escape route, and started moving me every week, moving me, shaking me down, tearing my property up, and just it was pretty horrific. And he kept moving me in cells that psych patients had been in. So sometimes there was feces all over the walls or all over the floors, and they wouldn't give me things to clean up with. I had to do it with my own material, my own cloth and things like that. And I think it was in 95 that at first I thought they were going to do it for a long time, like maybe 2 or 3 months or something like that. But it ended up being like they moved me every week for like 14 years straight. And as I was put in the front cells, and where the inside towers could see into my cell, I started writing, taking notes of what was going on, what they were doing when they were shaking me down, and the people that they were putting in next to me, noises and chaos that they raised, beating on the walls and yelling and screaming and lighting fires and flooding. And I wrote all that down, and I couldn't sleep either because of these people they were putting me next to. I noted all that, and I filed a lawsuit, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 1995, and 95 or 96, anyway, they ended up, they stopped moving. I fought them for 4 years. They kept trying to dismiss the case for different reasons and different stages of the complaint, but in 2000, I ended up getting a win in the Fifth Circuit, and that's the one that's,
I should just. I'd like to just mention to your listeners that this win that you got in the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals was a really astonishing thing. You did this without a lawyer, pro se, and you won a decision in probably the toughest federal appeals court in the country for prisoners' rights, and that the decision that you did win had far-reaching consequences because it really ended up helping to move the law forward. Sorry to interrupt. I just thought your listeners might want to know that.
Yes, that's true. Everything you said, and. It was a challenge fighting those issues in there, knowing, especially knowing what my chances were with the Fifth Circuit, and especially the district courts in the neighboring area around there. But that was it. I won the suit, and then later on, the ACLU came in and filed, helped shut the unit down, and according with the Russell case, and I forget the other guy, Presley case. They ended up shutting the unit down, and I was the last one out, the first one in and the last one out. And I think that was very much because of you.
Margaret, how did you become aware of Roy and, you know, his situation? How did you guys connect?
I had done a case in early 2000 about conditions on Mississippi's death row, which was also in Parchman. It was a small corner of Unit 32. And that was a very groundbreaking case because it addressed a whole bunch of conditions that hadn't really been litigated in that way before. Roy got in touch with me and said, it's great that you're doing this for death row, but that's a tiny corner of Unit 32. Do you realize that there's 1,000 men in this supermax unit, Unit 32, and the conditions that we are in, that I am in, is just as terrible as on death row, and in some ways worse. And everybody there was in permanent solitary confinement, which is one of the most brutal possible tortures that can be inflicted on people, and everything else there was truly hell. So I realized that the guy who was getting in touch with me was the Roy Harper of the case Harper versus Showers, the win he'd had in the Fifth Circuit a year or two earlier. And I realized that this case could be a real wedge into accomplishing stuff legally that had not been accomplished before. I knew that this person, Roy Harper, must be a very, very brilliant guy, and also a very brave man to put himself out there where he could be subject to some really bad retaliation. So next time I went to visit Unit 32, that's when I first met Roy, and I was even more impressed in person by seeing his courage and the clarity that he brought to all of these issues. So he became, over the next several years of litigation, my main point of contact. I knew that every single word out of his mouth that he would tell me would be true, that I found out over time that everything was accurate. There was no exaggeration, that he was going to be the most valuable person in a class action case. So that's how we met. He ended up helping to publicize the case through an interview with the New York Times. In all of the quarter century that I spent litigating prison conditions and class actions around the country, Roy is certainly one of the most extraordinary people that I've met, either in or out of prison.
Wow, well, very, very nice work. Can you guys talk a little bit about, I know Unit 32, you said, was closed down. How have conditions changed, you know, at this point? What improvements have been realized as a result of your efforts?
Go ahead, Roy.
32 was closed down, and they shipped us all to 29. And it's changed, but the conditions are just as bad there. They were fantastic when you first got there. But then with the deputy commissioner leaving, things went downhill ever since, and it's gotten pretty rough over there now. Margaret?
Yeah, it's kind of a tragic situation. There needs to be some other solution because unless you keep litigating, unless you are constantly in court forcing the Department of Corrections to keep things basically, you know, at a level of basic humanity where it's not torture, things do deteriorate and possibly very rapidly when there's a change of administration. Yeah, it's not a good situation there. And what the litigation that Roy participated in did was to show what is possible. And it actually helped inspire litigation around the country, successful litigation, to bring the issue of solitary confinement to the forefront of people's minds. So in that sense, I think that litigation had a permanent and lasting positive impact, very important nationally.
Well, very, very nice.
Thank you very much.
Margaret, do you have other questions for Roy?
No, just a comment that, Roy, it's great to hear your voice, and I'm thinking of you and wishing you well.
Yeah, you too. I've been trying to call you, and then I'll keep that effort up.
Good.
All right.
I do miss you.
Well, Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, Margaret. And I will bring on our next caller. Hi, we have a caller from area code 516. You're live on Nora on the radio. Who do we have on the line?
Hey, number one, I respect you for doing this podcast. You know, not a lot of people give authors notice. Number two, Roy, can I get an autographed copy of Shank?
yeah, sure.
For real?
I need an address. Huh?
I'm in Long Island.
Say that again?
I'm in Long Island.
Long Island? Okay,
yeah.
If you want
cool.
to, if you don't want to give your address over the air, I can give you an email address you can send it to, and then I will work behind the scenes to get that to Roy. Would you prefer
I'll get
that?
It over the air. No, nobody's trying to kill me.
All right. there we go.
111 Jefferson Avenue, Mineola, New York. 11501. Hey, thanks a lot, Roy. I appreciate it, man. And you know what happened to you is a tragedy, man. You know, I was watching this movie called the Stanford Experiment. I think it's called something like that. Have you ever seen it? Right.
What is it? Stanford Experiment?
Yeah. It was like in 1971 where they, like, this professor, he took 9 students and 9 people, 9 other students to be prison guards and 9 of them to be prisoners. And, the experiment ended after 6 days because the students couldn't take as much, you know, and I can only imagine an innocent victim going through, I mean, I don't know, like, that. Can you speak about it a little, like, how hard it was? I guess you kind of just did with the last caller, but
Where do you mean? Unit 32 or 29? Unit 32, or do you mean Unit 29?
No, I'm not part of a unit, no. I just like your books.
Yeah.
Where do I mean where was the roughest experience? I guess either or, your overall experience.
As far as segregation in Unit 32, it was isolation there, I think, more than anything. And especially, we had months of lockdown sometimes where you would never even get to communicate with anybody else until you were allowed out on the yard again. And I think that was one of the most telling things in there, was how it affected your mentality, because you didn't have anything to distract your mind from the harshness of the facility other than somebody to talk to. And when you're locked down and you're not being allowed to go on the yard or anything like that, you're much more isolated. And the people they were putting next to me were often psych patients. In other words, nut cases. They would light fires and flood and beat on the walls and on the tin and throw things at people and you know, just various different unrealistic attitudes towards life in general in prison. And dealing with that from day to day takes a toll on you, especially when you're the isolation part is really bad, because you don't have anything to think about except what's going on next door to you or around you. It's a constant negative influence on your life.
Do you think that would affect people? I mean, obviously it will affect them in a negative way. Can only strong people handle something like that?
After going through all the explanations of what this place was like, the shakedowns and the psych patients and the moving and the screaming, the federal judge that was in the case that Margaret Winter litigated was that there are people in there that are on shaky ground anyway, psychologically. And the judge said that this would challenge the mentality of even a strong man, much less somebody that's already unbalanced. So, yes, it was definitely challenging for everybody.
I'm sorry for everything, man. I love your book. And I'm so appreciative that you could give me an autographed copy.
Yes, sir.
You know.
Fantastic.
Thank
you for calling.
Remaining.
Hey, we will go ahead and reconnect, but caller, I'll follow up with a question with Roy when he comes back. Something that's related to some of the things you've been asking. We'll have Roy to share about. Roy, if you want to go ahead and drop and then dial back in, we'll get back rolling again.
All right.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Okay. And while we're waiting for Roy to reconnect, just a reminder of the show coming up tomorrow night. We'll be talking to Sean Cosby, and we'll have Rob Pierce, Tony Knighton joining us as well. And we'll be discussing the influence and impact of the Parker novels by Richard Stark. You'll want to join us for that. And just a quick plug for some of the podcasts that we have out there recorded from previous shows. I have recently interviewed Rob Pierce. He came on and talked about his novel With the Right Enemies, which is one that you don't want to miss. It's a sequel or follow-up to last year's Uncle Dust. And this is a hard-hitting novel that you will definitely want to check out if you haven't yet. And recent guests have included Jane DiBiasio, Daniel Velasity, Elka Ray, and Tony Knighton, all on talking about their recent releases. So I encourage you to check out the podcasts. They're out there on iTunes. Just search for Noir on the Radio, Greg Barth, and we will you'll be able to find those. I see Roy is coming back through now, so I'm just going to connect back with him. And here we are. Roy, welcome back.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm wondering if you could share, with the caller that we have on. You had a recent injury in Colorado that was pretty graphic and I'm sure a very hard thing to go through. Do you want to talk about that? Share anything around that injury?
Yeah, sure. In Mississippi, I've been in a cell by myself for like 36 years. And they transferred me here to Colorado and from Denver. It's the diagnostic center. They sent me from there to here in Sterling, which is supposed to be their worst prison. But anyway, I had a cell partner here, and I didn't have any arguments with him or disagreements or anything. And I guess apparently, I was in a cell with him for a couple of weeks, two or three weeks, and I went to sleep one night, and I guess he hit me in the head with something. I don't know what it was. And then he attacked me, and I guess that knocked me out. And then he attacked me and started stabbing me in the eyes with a pencil. And one of those stab wounds went into my brain. And that's what brought me back to awareness, was the pencil attacks. And I started resisting, trying to grab hold of his hands to stop him from stabbing me. And anyway, he figured out he wasn't going to be able to do that anymore. And he was kind of on the losing end of it. So anyway, he told me to push the button. We got intercoms in our cells. He told me to push the button and tell the police that he had attacked me. And
wow.
I did that. They came and got me. And when they opened my door, that's the last thing I remember, the police opening my door. And I woke up like a month later in the hospital in Denver.
Wow. That's just brutal, man. I hope conditions are better for you now and you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. Before the caller, I want to just reassure you that we've got the information and we will get you the autographed copies of the book. So, thanks for calling in and asking. It was great having you on. Roy, your stories, your novels, they have a real strong sense of place, whether the setting is, Parchman, Mississippi, Kentucky, Louisville, Cincinnati, Columbus, you really bring the reader there through your words. How important are these settings for you, and why do you choose these locations to feature?
Well, I think setting is vitally important, because when you're writing a story, you want this person to see where it is that you're writing about, the setting that the protagonist is in and what's going on around us in the city. And the South has a particularly unique setting and people and the atmosphere of that whole part of the country. And if you can put people there in that setting, whatever it happens to be, wherever it happens to be, then you've accomplished. You've already written like maybe half the story, just with the setting.
Yeah, definitely. It's well done with the setting, and you really get a sense of the place there. Wanted to ask you about also with settings. There seems to be I kind of notice a little bit of a contrast. You have that piece of the forest, the backcountry, where Dave and Rose are living and enjoying life in a rural setting, versus maybe the evil of the institution or the complexities of the city. you know, where he has his skirmishes with the law and where his pipes go down. You know, is that intentional on your part? Do you see the forest and the rural area as being an ideal sort of life?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. Anytime you think about a place that, like maybe a place for retirement or a place for a vacation or whatever, that's usually what people think about, is something that's relaxed and not too many people around and just in the country, you know. And the cities are, it's a constant threat when you're on the run, because any car that you see or any person that you see could end up being the law. They could end up confronting you some kind of way and causing a major disaster to your life as an escaped convict or whatever you happen to be. And the cities are definitely a threatening, dangerous place for an escaped person. And I think the setting in the country is really laid back, and if you've got somebody like Rose with you, it makes it, that's like the icing on the cake, you know.
Rose is a bit of an outlaw herself in the books. Don't want to give too much away, but you know, what would you say draws us to stories about outlaws? You know, with this being noir on the radio, you know, I talk to a lot of guys who write about and women who write about you know, people who don't live by rules, right? Why do you think we want to read about them and, you know, maybe even be like them?
I think because being an outlaw is a freedom. It's sets you loose from the boundaries of society, the boundaries of law, and the things that hold you back, speed limits, and where you can and can't go, what you can and can't do. If you have no boundaries there, then that's the freedom that it gives you. And a person that violates those boundaries, is somebody that people tend to admire. Some people do. Not all people, but some people do.
Yeah, that's great. I agree. I think we get to live that kind of life, you know, vicariously through the fiction of it. Now, do you consider yourself to be an outlaw still today?
Yeah, I think so. Not nearly to the degree I was back when I was younger. Yeah, I still do have my thoughts and my ways of life that are something other than what the law would appreciate, you know.
Indeed. Can you tell us a little bit about your writing process? You know, as you're writing, is it complicated by being in prison? You know, how do you write these, you know, these beautiful novels from a prison cell, being moved from cell to cell each week? How does that work for you?
That was I wrote that book from Unit 32 before they stopped moving me, and I got to tell you, it was challenging, because not only the moves and the constant screaming and yelling and everything that was going on, but I had to constantly worry that somebody was going to take my manuscript or something, that it was going to get destroyed in a flood or something like that. And, getting paper and writing material was, it was not that hard. I mean, I wasn't supposed to have all of it, but I did, and they didn't. And nobody ever bothered me about it, which was a fortunate incident. But being moved like that and harassed and every week, and sometimes I couldn't even write for a whole week, you know, because it took me so long to clean the cell and get everything together and get my mind back together before I could get back into my writing. And then it was time to move again. So, yeah, being locked down like that was definitely challenging.
Man, I bet. And then you had to hold that manuscript together and protect it for months, I would imagine. And, you know, I talk to a lot of writers, and people talk to me about how they have to have absolute silence to be able to write. They have to have, you know, a certain kind of music to be able to write. But, man, you just do it in the, you know, some of the worst settings or circumstances imaginable. And like I say, these are excellent, excellent books. So well done on your part. It's pretty amazing. Another thing I was thinking of when I read Shank and Heist, you know, I was reminded of some writers that have had an influence on me as a writer. And I'm thinking of, you know, people like Edward Bunker, Louis L'Amour, Zane Grey, some of those guys. Can you share with us, you know, which authors have had the most influence on your writing?
Yes. I think Louis L'Amour was number one. He always has been. And, matter of fact, when he died, it broke my heart. You know? But it was a pretty tough thing. But, and again, back to the setting. Louis L'Amour wrote his settings more superbly than anyone. And he was just fantastic with it. But the way he wrote, the way his characters talked and spoke and everything, and the way they thought. One of the things I liked about him was that he never cussed. I mean, not in the way that we cuss today, you know. And he was most definitely a huge influence in my writing.
I can see the influence. I kind of cut my teeth on those Louis L'Amour novels back when I was growing up and, you know, learning how to write. And, you know, they've had a profound impact on me for the better, I think. And, you know, it's just great to kind of see that and recognize that in, you know, somebody else's work and to hear that. What's new and upcoming from you, Roy? Any new book releases we should be watching for in the near future?
Yeah, I have one now. It's kind of a prequel to the one that I've already written, to Heist, because, you know, the kid in there that Tool takes in, and it ends up helping him pull his heist. He had a life before he met Tool, you know, although it was only like a few years, you know. He was just a juvenile. But he was a runaway. He ran away from his uncle, and he lived on his own, stealing and burglarizing places to support himself. And that's going to be coming out. Well, in fact, it's already written. What I'm doing now is waiting for an opportunity to get it typed. And I think that opportunity might be coming very soon.
Well, great to hear. I can't wait to read more about Best Ball and all these interesting characters that you've created. Where's the best place that folks can keep up with you? Is it on Crime Wave Press website or the Amazon author page? Any other places we can watch for you?
I think Crime Wave Press is the best place.
Good deal. Do you have any closing words for us today, Roy? Anything you didn't get to talk about while we were on?
No, except this new prison they got me in. Although I've been hurt since I've been here, it's a fantastic place. Mississippi was a dump, and everything falling apart, and run chaotically by chaotic people, and this place here is completely different. I mean, it's ran. It's a wonderful place for a prison.
Well, man, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, it's, you know, it's good to hear that you're in a good place. Your story is, you know, so compelling, and just to hear, you know, you and Margaret talking about the good work that you've done to improve conditions and all that you've been through. It's you know, it's nice to leave the show knowing that you're in a better place, and we wish you the very best, Roy. I can't thank you enough, you know, for coming on the show and talking to us about your work. It's, you know, it's been great getting to know you. It's been great having you on, and, you know, we wish you the very best, and I hope you'll we can do this again when your next book is released.
I look forward to it, and hey, I do appreciate the interview.
Well, you're welcome, man. It's been a pure joy. And for the audience, you know, I would say check out Roy Harper's novels, Shank and Heist. You can find them both easily on Amazon. And, you know, I ask you to join me again for the next show. My guest will be crime author Chris Roy, and I'll be talking to Chris tonight, actually, Saturday, March the 11th at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. You won't want to miss that. This is going to be a fantastic show. Chris has got a great new book out called Shocking Circumstances that you're going to want to hear Chris Roy talk about that book. It's really fantastic. So until then, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. Thank you.